there's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
What exactly do we lose if we jeopardize the deepest stretches of the ocean? Helen Scales will be here to talk about her new book, The Brilliant Abyss. How did an American woman in Germany stand up to Hitler and the Nazi Party? Rebecca Donner will be here to talk about All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days, the true story of the American woman at the heart of the German resistance to Hitler. Liz Harris will be here with the latest in publishing news, plus my colleagues and I will talk about what we're reading. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's August 20th. I'm Pamela Paul. Helen Scales joins us now from rural Brittany in France. Her new book is called The Brilliant Abyss, Exploring the Majestic Hidden Life of the Deep Ocean and the Looming Threat that Imperils It. Helen, thanks for being here.
Pamela, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So you've written a number of books about the ocean and the creatures that live within it, including octopuses, Eye of the Shoal, the Great Barrier Reef, Spirals in Time, and several others. How do you find your subjects each time?
I always find myself diving back into the ocean and into a topic that always, at the time, suddenly feels enormous and big and uncontrollable. And I wonder how I got there. But I guess I follow either collections of stories that have come my way. So the Shells book I wrote was the sort of realization that I had all these different stories about human connections to seashells I wanted to tell. And then for this latest one about the deep ocean, it was this, a kind of deepening of my awareness of the importance and the enormous wonders of the ocean, and realizing that there were incredible stories to tell from those dark depths that we don't really get to see so much.
Obviously, these are all different subjects about the sea and sea life, but they are all about the ocean. What got you interested in the ocean to begin with?
So I've been an ocean kid, I guess, certainly from my teenage years. I was always a very nature-loving kid. I was always running around outside, enjoying the mud and the creatures outdoors. And then, I spent a lot of family holidays in the English equivalent of where I am right now in France. The northern bit to us is Cornwall, which sticks out into the Atlantic. So I was very used to exploring those coasts. And so I think that's when the sea kind of seeped into me, into my blood, if you like. And then, in my teens, I learned to scuba dive. I put my head in the water for the first time, breathed like a fish, was completely hooked by the physical sensation of it, and then took my first open water dive, saw my first fish, and that was it for me. It was just occupying that world and seeing what happens beneath that water. Waterline, I think for me, it was just so intriguing to immerse myself in this other part of our world that you don't normally see. And I just wanted to know more and more about it. So for me, I think it really began with my personal exploration and it kind of took off from there, really.
I can see already that it's going to be impossible to avoid all kinds of puns during this conversation, like deep dive and immersing yourself and plunging in and all of that. But we'll just put that aside and people will just have to forgive us. But since you mentioned scuba diving, I'm curious, how deep do you go, given that this is a book about the deep sea?
Actually, I have not been into the official deep myself, but then a lot of marine scientists who specialize in the deep ocean don't actually get to go there. That's one of the wonderful things about deep exploration, is that there's so much technology at our fingertips to do it remotely. So, I went on a deep sea research expedition as part of the book, spent some time in the Gulf of Mexico, but, I was almost kind of frustrated that we all had to stay on the ship. And that was the way it was. You stay on board, you send robots down there 2,000 meters, so 6,000 feet beneath you, and you're you're seeing into this world and you're doing studies and you're you know, manipulating stuff with this amazing piece of equipment, but you're not going there yourself. You're just sort of this remote explorer, if you like, even though we're pretty close, you know, we're hovering above it. So personally, you know, I've only scuba dived. I haven't yet been inside a submersible. I'm still waiting for my invitation from someone who has one to let me come on board. And I would definitely do that. Although I am a bit claustrophobic. So it would be a case of kind of getting over that and deciding it was worth my while to get down into the very deep parts of the ocean. So on my own scuba diving, I've been to about 40 meters, so 120 feet.
You refer to something as the official deep. What is the official deep? Because 120 feet sounds pretty deep.
The beginning of where the conditions in the ocean change significantly. And we're talking about pressure. We're talking about specifically sunlight. So really, the deep ocean is where sunlight is running out. And that's a really important factor for life in the oceans. And in fact, you know, it wasn't so long ago, maybe 200 years ago, that most people, scientists, you know, the brightest minds we had, assumed that life only went down as far as pretty much sunlight reaches. So the first 600 feet or so, that's the sunlit zone of the ocean that we know of. It's where the most of the life that we know in the ocean exists, in that upper layer. It was assumed there was nothing down deeper. How could it be? There's no sunlight, which is how we get all our food. At least that's what we thought at the time. And the pressure is so high and it gets really cold and dark. So how can anything survive? But actually, the whole idea of life in the deep and what's so fascinating about it is that life does go all the way to the very, very bottom, down to like 7 miles, which is the deepest point just about. And there are ways in which life has found adaptations to all of these crazy extreme conditions in the deep. And that's what we're really doing a lot of the time as marine biologists working in the deep is finding that stuff and asking the question, how are you here? And often we're coming up with some pretty crazy answers to those questions as well.
When did we find that out, that there actually was life all the way down there?
The era of really discovering what's in the deep began in the mid-19th century, especially with expeditions, global expeditions like the HMS Challenger, which was a 2-year global oceanographic expedition that was the first to really comprehensively look at what was very deep down there. So enormous collections of animals were brought up from great depths. I'm not sure if they went and found life right at the bottom of the deepest trenches, which is things like the Mariana Trench in the Pacific, which is the one that's just shy of 7 miles. And it took people to go down there and for greater technologies to come along. So it was really more later on in the 20th century that we got the idea that life really does go all the way to the bottom. There are fish down there, there are shrimp, octopuses that can deal with these extreme conditions. It seems like there's just, you know, life can get everywhere, basically. There's nowhere sort of off limits for life on this planet and in the ocean.
Tell us a little bit about the Mariana Trench. Where exactly is it? When did we discover it? And why so deep there?
There's a couple of dozen trenches globally. A lot of them are in the Pacific Ocean. The Pacific is the biggest and the oldest ocean we have. It's around 250 million years old. It's the deepest. And at the edges of the Pacific, we get basically the point where oceanic plates, so these crusts that make up the bottom of the sea, are either pulling apart or crashing into each other. And it's these points where these tectonic plates are crashing together that you get these trenches. Basically, one is burrowing under the other and pushing down and down, and you get these V-shaped chasms. And, you know, Mariana is one of at least, I mean, there's a whole string of them. They reach from kind of Japan down through the western part of the Pacific. The Mariana is sort of off of Philippines, a bit further out and sort of south of Japan. But there's the Kuril Kamchatka, there's the Japan Trench, there's the Tonga Trench leading all the way down towards New Zealand. And all of these are more than 30,000 feet deep. It's extraordinary. I mean, we call this the Hadal Zone. Anything deeper than around 6,000 meters, so what, 12,000 feet. This named after the Greek underworld, Hades. This is the deepest part of the ocean, is this extraordinary sort of slice of life. And so we've known about these deep trenches, I think, since Challenger time, since the mid-19th century. Most notably, just this year, a whole load more people have been down into the Mariana Trench with a guy called Victor Vescovo. He was a billionaire financier who decided he wanted to go to the deepest part of each of the oceans.
Those billionaires who are not going into space are going all the way in the opposite direction.
Yeah, he's decided to go down. And he did. He's been to the bottom of the Indian. They found the deepest point in the Indian, the Pacific, the Atlantic. And now he has this incredible submersible called the Pressure Drop, and he's taking other people with him. He took Kathy Sullivan recently, who has been into space, an astronaut who went into space and has now been to the deepest part of the ocean. He recently took the youngest woman and the first Pacific Islander to who actually lives in this region down into the bottom of the Mariana Trench. So he's really opening up this place. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to do to get down there. It takes hours to drift down to the bottom. You have a sort of short window of time to see this deepest part before you have to come back up again. Kathy Sullivan has described it more like an elevator, and that going up into space was like being inside a bomb, and going down is like a very slow elevator ride.
Neither sounds especially pleasant, I have to say. But what is it that you would want most to see yourself going down to the bottom of the ocean? What questions drive you?
I mean, I guess there are organisms and there are ecosystems that I would love to witness. And I guess I'm very drawn to the idea of black smokers and hydrothermal vents. And these are extraordinary ecosystems that form. They're basically the deep sea equivalent of hot springs, only so much more extreme in the deep. Because of all the pressure, it means that there can be hundreds of degrees of heat without boiling because the pressure stops that from happening. And so we get these incredibly hot, incredibly toxic environments where nothing by rights should exist. There's very little oxygen, all these toxic chemicals in the water. It's really an unpleasant place, but it's full of life. Like, absolutely, like, it's one of these extraordinary concentrations of very strange life forms. They were first discovered in the late 70s, just off of the Galapagos Islands. And it was geologists who went to look for these things. They'd had this idea that there were hot plumes of fluids coming up from the seabed. And I should say these form not where plates are colliding like trenches, but where they're pulling apart. And you've got this kind of hot magma not too deep in the seabed. It's heating up fluids, causing this crazy conditions. So the geologists went down thinking that they were just going to look at sort of like a deep sea volcano, basically. Lo and behold, it was covered in life. Giant tube worms as tall as a human being. And since then, we've been going back and back and discovering more and more life. So, you know, if I could take a submersible down, I'd go to one of the hydrothermal vents we haven't been to yet, look out the window and maybe see animals that no one has seen yet. I would love to do that.
All right, now I want to get back to your question that you asked earlier of these creatures. How are you doing this? How do they survive? How did they evolve down there?
Staying with the vents, I mean, this was the extraordinary thing. Not only did these organisms have to deal with what everything in the deep sea does, which is the pressure. You know, we're talking, by the time we're getting down to what we would call the abyss, so around about 12,000 feet down, the pressure is as high as if you had a large African elephant stepping on every single square inch of your body. Pressures start to get so high that it isn't just a question of kind of, you know, it's getting a bit uncomfortable, but your cells can't really function. Your molecules are starting to get bent out of shape. And yet, at a molecular level, we have all these amazing adaptations that these organisms have. They basically kind of produce chemicals that protect them, stuff that's happening on this very small scale to keep themselves alive. But then we look at things like on hydrothermal vents and say, well, you know, how are they surviving? How are they feeding themselves? That's another big question. What food is available in this dark deep where there's no sunlight? So there's no plant life down there. So the base of the food chain that we know of out here on land just doesn't exist. There is some that falls down from above, particles of plankton that kind of fall down once they've died. And we call it marine snow, which sounds kind of nice, but it is mostly just dead remains of sea creatures from the surface. And that is the food that most organisms and animals in the deep feed on. So we have wonderful things drifting around like jellyfish, like vampire squid.
What's a vampire squid?
They look pretty terrifying. They're this kind of blood red squid. They have a bone white beak with hooks on their tentacles. They look pretty fearsome, but actually they are the most gentle creatures. They're about the size of a football, I would say. And all they do is catch this marine snow as it's drifting down. They put out a filament, like a long kind of lure. It looks like a fishing line. And they let these particles, which just drift down from above. It does look like it's snowing in the deep. And they collect these organic rich particles and they pack them into little snowballs and they stuff them in their mouths. And that's how they feed. And a lot of other animals in the deep do the same thing. They'll either pick up this snow that's landed on the seabed or they'll catch it on its way down through the water column. But these vents, the ecosystems, these incredible black smokers, they form these tall chimneys. That's why we call them black smokers. It's fluids pouring out of them looking like, yeah, something out of some kind of version of hell, I guess. But covered in animals that have a whole other way of surviving. And this blew apart the kind of minds of biologists when it was first discovered back in the late 70s, when we figured out that there's a kind of alternative way of living that these ecosystems exploit. They don't rely on energy from the sunlight, which was up until that point, we assumed that all of life needed sunlight to survive. These guys survive on chemical energy instead. So instead of photosynthesis, it's this dark alternative called chemosynthesis. Essentially, it's microbes. So rather than plants and seaweeds, it's just little microbes, bacteria that are harnessing energy from chemicals that are pouring out of these vents. And then pretty much everything else eats those microbes. So for example, one of my favorites are things called Yeti crabs. That's kind of their nickname. These little white crabs were discovered a while ago. They have wonderful fairy arms. So these great big long fairy arms, hence Yeti crabs. They don't eat marine snow. I think that would have been kind of poetic if they did. Turns out that basically they grow these microbes in their fur. So they're farming these chemosynthetic chemical harnessing bacteria in their fur, and then it's just eating them. That's what they do. That's how they survive down there. So it's pretty strange, very, very different forms of food webs down there. I guess that's one thing we're learning from the deep is that life can be very different. And we've really had to open our minds as to, you know, thinking about what life can be. And the deep is showing us that it can be a lot of very, very different things to life out here on land. But we're all here on Earth and we're all, you know, occupying this same incredible space together.
And we're all interconnected, as we know, increasingly and increasingly in a distressing way when it comes to the environment. How is the deep sea environment important to the rest of the planet? If things go awry down there, and I'm going back to the second part of your subtitle, the looming threat that imperils it. If things go awry down there, what do we care up here? Why should it matter?
With the oceans in general, this is an issue of it being out of sight and out of mind. And then the deep sea is just the extreme version of that, that we know very few people get to go there, you know, or even see it directly. And yet there are really important connections from the air that we breathe to the food that we eat. The deep ocean, it's an enormous volume, something like a billion cubic kilometers, if you can imagine that much. But this huge volume that we have of the deep has absorbed enormous amounts of heat. So 90% of the heat that's been trapped in the atmosphere by climate change has ended up in the deep ocean. So already it's saving us from a really catastrophic version of climate change than we already face. So, you know, the deep is saving us from that. It's absorbing carbon on an enormous scale. So those sorts of climate processes are really tightly wound up in the deep ocean. And then, you know, there's things like the fact that, in fact, something like 25% of all the fish that we're catching from the ocean is fed by nutrients that are flowing back up from the deep sea as well. So it's like the deep is generating nutrients. It's taking carbon out of the atmosphere. It's taking heat. It's making things work on a scale that we're still also learning more and more about those different connections. It's full of potentially new chemicals that we can make medicines out of, all sorts of things we could be using the deep for, and stuff that we are just kind of taking for granted right now because it's all just happening without us realizing it. The air we breathe, the climate that we inhabit, we have the deep ocean to thank for a lot of things.
Well, obviously, we should all care about it a lot more. And we should read this book. The title again is The Brilliant Abyss, Exploring the Majestic Hidden Life of the Deep Ocean and the Looming Threat that Imperils It. Helen, I hope this pushes your name up a little bit further on the wait list for the next submersible. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a real treat.
Helen Scales' new book is called The Brilliant Abyss, and it's reviewed on the cover of the Book Review this week.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Tina Jordan joins us now to help celebrate the 125th anniversary of the Book Review. Tina, hey.
Hey, Pamela. I'm going to bring you today one of my favorite op-eds from the book review, and it's not something we do anymore, but in the past, actually for the first few decades of the book review, we ran op-eds every week. And this one I thought was sort of starting out as a news story, and it turned into an op-ed, and it's about the revival of what the book review calls little books, quote unquote. And the editor says that the bibliophile of the future will undoubtedly name the 20th century the age of little books. And he points out, because of course it was a he, if there should suddenly appear in the new market a volume with the bulk of those elephantine tomes which our ancestors delighted, it would have the look of a dinosaur cropping the topmost leaves of an elm in a city park, or a whale among goldfish. And then he goes on to speculate why books have gotten so much smaller in size. And he says, honestly, he thinks it has to do with commuters, because you're on the train, you can't carry a whole quarto, you know, or folio around with you. And he says 20 years ago, these readers had no other literary resource than the newspaper. Now, this is what's going to make you sad. Today, you'll see these commuters taking their seat in the Pullman coach, drag a small edition of Shakespeare or Omar Khayyam from their pockets, read a page or so, and then sit for a mile after mile with a faraway smile. And I'm like, if only. I don't think people are reading Shakespeare or Omar Khayyam on their commutes anymore. But actually, the book review editor says, look, the effects of shorter books upon literature will be almost entirely for the good. Authors will be called upon to write chapters where they now write whole volumes. They must learn to trim and to condense. The most successful writers of this good day coming on will not strive to put forth 500,000 words per year, but to pack more matter into 50,000 words. So there you go.
All right. Well, I don't mind small books. I like small books. And they are good for commuting.
They are good for commuting. And I've never dragged a 1,000-page tome on the train before. It is too heavy.
I have done it, and it is too heavy.
Yeah. Have you ever done that thing where you rip a book in half?
Tina Jordan. Really?
I'm sorry.
A book or a galley book?
A galley or a paperback.
All right. Maybe it's okay.
Okay, fine.
Tina, thank you.
Thank you, Pamela.
Rebecca Donner joins us now. Her new book is called All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days, The True Story of the American Woman at the Heart of the German Resistance to Hitler. Rebecca, thanks for being here.
Pamela, thank you so much for having me.
And it's also a New York Times bestseller, so congratulations.
Thank you so much.
This book, we should just say outright, is part of your family story, but it's not your first book. Why did you wait, and how did you know that you were ready to write it?
Well, actually, this book has been gestating in me since I was quite young. When I was about 9 years old, I visited my great-grandmother's house in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and she asked me to stand against the kitchen wall, which all of the children did, and I had my height measured. And I stepped back and I looked at all the marks along the wall, and I saw one that was rather faint. And I asked, who's that? And there was an M next to it. And she said, well, that's Mildred. But she said nothing else. And I sensed that there was some tension in her voice. I sensed that there was a story there at the age of 9. And I wanted to find out more. And later, my brother and I explored the attic, and it was filled with musty clothes and children's board games and rubber banded stacks of playing cards. And I discovered this large jar of buttons, and some were ebony and hexagonal and square and mother of pearl. And my great grandmother allowed me to take that back, and I put it up on my shelf, and I glanced at it now and then. And I wondered if any of those buttons were Mildred's. She's my great, great aunt. And I learned more about her story when my grandmother, when I was 16, gave me Mildred's letters. And then she started telling me more of the story. And so the mystery of Mildred intrigued me all the more. And my grandmother, who knew that I had ambitions to be a writer, said to me, you must write her story. So at 16, I made a promise to my grandmother, and I intended to keep it.
All right, let's go back and talk a little bit more in depth about Mildred and her story. What led her to Germany in the first place?
Mildred was born and raised in Milwaukee. She came from a rather impoverished household, but she declared her desire to go to the University of Wisconsin, and she received her bachelor's degree there as well as her master's degree. And it was at the University of Wisconsin when she was a graduate student when she met Arvid Harnack, who was a German graduate student. And they fell in love and got married a week after she received her master's degree. And then in 1929, she decided to pursue her PhD in Germany. And so that's when she moved and enrolled in a PhD program and very quickly became involved in the underground resistance. She was appalled by the swastikas she saw everywhere. She was appalled that at the University of Gießen, where she was attending lectures, 50% of the students were involved in the Nazi fraternity. And so she decided to do something about it.
And was Arvid 100% with her on all of this?
Yes, absolutely. At the University of Wisconsin, they were politically active. They hitchhiked to Colorado to attend a strike where there were coal miners on strike, and they walked the picket lines with them. Mildred was very much involved in advocating for women's rights. Her mother was a suffragette, and Arvid shared those beliefs as well.
So how did she go from working in the underground resistance to becoming an all-out spy?
Yes, it was quite a trajectory. In 1932, this was before Hitler became chancellor, she began holding meetings in her apartment in Berlin. And she invited friends and friends of friends and students. At that time, she was lecturing at the University of Berlin. And the students there were a source of recruits for her. And she was frank in expressing her opinions about the Nazi party. In the summer of 1932, Mildred was abruptly fired from the University of Berlin. And she got the clear message that encouraging students to express their political beliefs would not be tolerated. She started teaching at a night school in Berlin. And at this night school, it was for adults who did not yet have a college degree. They were largely working class and unemployed Germans. And this was a segment of the population that the Nazi Party relentlessly targeted with propaganda. Some of the most effective members of Mildred's, what became a resistance group, were her students from this school. It's important to remember that after Hitler became chancellor in 1933, Germany swiftly transformed from a parliamentary democracy into a dictatorship. And so it became much more difficult for Mildred to recruit her students into this group because she had to be careful. If she asked the wrong person to join her group, she could easily be turned over to the Gestapo. Initially, the first weapon that this group had was paper, really. They wrote leaflets that denounced Hitler and the Nazi regime. It was an exceedingly dangerous undertaking because if you were caught with a leaflet that denounced Hitler, you could be sent to a concentration camp for a year. And that's indeed what happened to several of her recruits. In 1935, Mildred and Arvid decided that it was important to reach beyond Germany's borders and to make contact with members of the resistance in other countries. And her American passport was very advantageous. So she was able to move more freely than her German co-conspirators. And so she traveled to France and England and Norway and Switzerland and Denmark. And she also used her connections at the American Embassy in Berlin to help Jews escape Germany. And during this time, her husband, Arvid Harnack, got a job at the Ministry of Economics. His aim was to essentially steal information to obtain top secret documents about Hitler's operational strategies and give them to Hitler's enemies.
So this kind of work on Mildred's part is pretty unusual and risky, as you said, and ballsy. And looking back over her childhood and her education, things that you learned through research for this book, or maybe from your great-grandmother or others in the family, What do you think may have led her down this path? It's a pretty extraordinary action to take, especially as a foreigner living in Germany.
Mildred, when she was in Berlin, would write to her mother and tell her about how she was so inspired by the memory of how hard her mother worked. And that emboldened her. In one of her letters, she describes how she sees a woman about her mother's age trying to sell wilted cabbages. And she says to her mother, you know, I thought of you. And she also says in these letters, I have to do something about this. She decided that she couldn't just stand by and watch. She had to actively oppose the Nazi party.
Did she think of herself as a resistance fighter? Did she think of herself as a spy? What did she see as her role?
Oh, she most definitely saw herself as a resistance fighter, and she certainly did not see herself as a spy. She engaged in acts of espionage in order to undermine the Nazi regime, but she never met with a control officer. She never accepted money. She worked in an unofficial capacity, you might say. In 1939, when she began involved in espionage on behalf of the United States, it must be remembered that the United States had no centralized intelligence agency at that time. And so she had an arrangement with a diplomat at the U.S. Embassy in Berlin to pass information that Arvid, her husband, had obtained top secret intelligence about Hitler's operational and military strategies. She had an arrangement with this diplomat, Donald Heath, that they would use his son, his 11-year-old son, as a courier. And the son would show up at Mildred's apartment twice a week for tutoring sessions. And at the end of these sessions, Mildred would slip into his knapsack piece of paper that he would then bring back to his father. This went on between 1939 and 1941.
Let's talk about the boy, Donald Heath Jr. Who was he and how did you discover him? Because he becomes a very big part of your narrative. You have alternating sections called The Boy about Donald Heath Jr.
Yes. Well, my grandmother told me about Don Heath when I was 16. Years later, when I began researching this book, I thought, I need to track him down. And indeed I did. He was 89 years old. He was living in Northern California. And after he passed away, his family permitted me to review the contents of 12 steamer trunks that contained Donald Heath Sr.'s unpublished memoir and correspondence with the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau Jr., as well as letters and diaries written by Don Heath's mother, Louise, between 1939 and 1941.
I don't mean to completely jump ahead or to give away the ending, but some of it we do know right away, which is, of course, that Mildred was given the death penalty.
Yes.
Directly by Hitler. What happened on February 16th, 1943? And how did she get there? Because originally it wasn't the death penalty.
The Gestapo tracked her down in Nazi-occupied Lithuania as she and her husband were trying to escape in the fall of 1942. They were thrown into prison at Gestapo headquarters. She was transferred to a women's prison, and she was interrogated and tortured over the course of 3.5 months. There was a mass trial, a top secret mass trial. And in December 1942, she walked into a courtroom, and she was given a sentence of 6 years in prison. 2 days later, Hitler found out about her sentence and reversed it and ordered her execution.
Let's go back to the title, All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days. That's a quote. Where does it come from? And why did you choose that for the title of this book?
It comes from a volume of Goethe poetry that Mildred was translating in her prison cell shortly before she was executed. A prison chaplain who was secretly in the resistance visited her about an hour before her execution, and he saw her bent over this book, scribbling in the margins with a pencil stub, and she was scribbling translations of these poems. And so All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days is a line from one of these poems.
And why did you choose that as the title?
I felt like it was such an apt description of the contents of the book. There are so many troubles that the people in the book suffer through and endure, not just Mildred, but people in her resistance group. And nearly all of them were executed.
Well, it's a very fitting title for this book. An incredible story. Rebecca, thank you so much for being here.
Pamela, thank you so much.
Rebecca Donner's new book is called All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days, The True Story of the American Woman at the Heart of the German Resistance to Hitler, and it's a New York Times bestseller. Elizabeth Harris joins us now with some news in the publishing world. Hey, Liz.
Hi, Pamela. So the big book news this week is that Hachette, which is one of the five biggest publishers in the country, has agreed to buy Workman Publishing, which was one of the biggest independent publishing houses. They're known for books like What to Expect When You're Expecting or Braincrest workbooks, which are huge in my household. They're like little brain teasers for kids. Hachette has agreed to pay $240 million for them. And this is just the latest in a march towards consolidation that's been happening in the publishing industry for years now. Penguin and Random House merged in 2013. News Corp, which owns HarperCollins, bought the romance publisher Harlequin. Hachette recently bought Perseus Books. And right now, there's a group of five big publishers that have just a huge amount of market share. But Penguin Random House has agreed to buy Simon & Schuster, which, if that is approved by federal regulators, would make that number of big players in the industry even smaller. And sort of instead of the big five, there would be the big four. So this is just another step in the big ones getting bigger. And it's just really difficult to compete on a number of levels, but like for on just a basic infrastructure level, it's really difficult to be a small player when the big guys have these whole distribution channels and warehouses and all of this stuff that the little ones just don't have.
All right. I'm curious about the motivations on each side. So Workman, of course, was founded by the late Peter Workman, was this always very proudly independent publisher with its own very particular culture, its focus on backlist over constantly prioritizing frontlist. As you said, like some of their bestsellers from way back when are still their best-selling books. Why do they want to sell themselves?
Peter Workman died a few years ago, and his wife, Carol Ann Workman, has been running it ever since. And she said that the succession plan for the business is, as you said, it's been a family business, has always been to sell. And they went into this process open to a number of different possibilities, but Hachette made the best offer. And one of the things that she in particular was very passionate about was trying to protect the staff. She's not just trying to be nice to her employees. They have sort of a unique mix at Workman. They own a lot of their own intellectual property, like which basically means that a lot of the books they produce are their own ideas. And so the staff is responsible for coming up with these great ideas. So her view was, if you start cutting away at the staff, you're cutting away at our idea machine. You're cutting away at what makes it such a strong company. And Hachette made an agreement to basically keep the company whole and just absorb it. And then from Hachette's perspective, they're very strong in fiction. They want to grow a bit in nonfiction, and Workman, you know, is very strong in nonfiction. They also really want, as you said, the backlist. Their backlist is really, really strong. I mean, so What to Expect When You're Expecting has become sort of its own little franchise with a bunch of different pregnancy and parenting books, and they have more than 40 million copies in print of those books. And they also just have little books that just kept chugging along for decades. They published a book in the mid-70s called Carrots Love Tomatoes, which is about plants that grow well together in your garden. And it's been reprinted 87 times.
87 times? That's crazy.
Yeah, every year people just want to know, like, okay, what do I put in my garden? And so they just keep buying this book. And so they have this incredibly strong backlist that was very appealing to Hachette.
Got it. The consolidation movement marches on. What else is going on?
Well, another story we had this week was about books on race and racism in America. So over the past year, books on these subjects have sold really quite well, and in some cases, incredibly well. How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ingram Kendi has sold nearly 2 million copies since it was published 2 years ago, which is just enormous for a nonfiction book on a serious subject. But most of the books that have been out in the world over the past year on these topics have come at it from a progressive perspective. And now there are books coming out on race in America through a conservative lens. And some of these are starting to do really well also. There's a book called Blackout, How Black Americans Can Make Its Second Escape from the Democrat Plantation Fermentation, which is by the right-wing media personality Candace Owens. And that has sold 480,000 copies since it was published in the fall by a conservative imprint at Simon & Schuster. There are a bunch more of these books coming out with titles like I Can't Breathe, How a Racial Hoax is Killing America, and Race Crazy, BLM, 1619, and the Progressive Racism Movement. So part of what's happening here is conservative publishers are seeing an opportunity in the backlash to the national conversation about race and racism in America. And then very specifically, they're seeing a market in books that address critical race theory specifically, which is having quite a moment of its own. Critical race theory is an academic framework that looks at the role of the law and other institutions in racial inequality and perpetuating racial inequality, rather than focusing on the prejudice of individual people. And critics say it's divisive and it portrays whiteness as inherently bad and unfairly paints the country as irredeemably racist. But academics who embrace critical race theory say it has been intentionally misrepresented. So now critical race theory is all over conservative media outlets like Fox News. And all of this is happening as the Republican Party plans to focus on culture war issues as it tries to retake the House and Senate in midterms next year. And at the state level, this has really exploded. And at least 21 states have introduced or passed legislation that restricts how schools can address race or racism in classrooms. So all of this is to say that there's a lot of interest in these issues on the right. And the book American Marxism by the bestselling author Mark Levin has a chapter on critical race theory, and that book sold 400,000 copies in just its first week on the market last month.
A lot of these books on both sides are on the bestseller list. It's interesting, a kind of very polarized divide.
It's similar in some ways to political books, where there are these books that are talking to, you know, big chunks of the country, but there's so little overlap. You know, the people who are going to buy How to Be an Anti-Racist are very unlikely to buy American Marxism. And so there are these hungry markets on either side, but there isn't a lot in the middle and there aren't a lot of crossover readers, it seems.
I was going to say, what are the books in the middle? Where are the moderate books?
I'll try and find you some.
All right. Next time. Liz, thank you so much. Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, my colleagues John Williams and Gaul Beckerman. Hey, guys.
Hey. Hey, Pamela.
John, what are you reading?
I often talk on here about what I'm reading outside of work, but I've been reading a lot for work lately, so I'm going to draw on that. I've reviewed a book this week called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals by Oliver Berkman, who's a British journalist based in New York. As you can tell from the subtitle, this is essentially a self-help book, but I would put it on the literary side of that genre. Berkman's a really good writer. He's very wry. He had a column for The Guardian for a long time, a weekly column called This Column Will Change Your Life. And it was, he would sort of survey books somewhat like this and more, more of those kind of how to get everything done in 3 hours a day kind of books with a skeptical eye and with a sense of humor. And here he offers his own tips for productivity, but also philosophical ideas about why the entire way we approach time management is unhealthy. You know, the idea that we even think of time as these hours, as these units that we use for productivity, and that some are used well and some are used badly. We have 4,000 weeks to live, the average person, as the title suggests.
Oh, God.
Right. And so his point is, you know, a lot of the things that we're told to do, like efficiently get through daily tasks, like emailing at work and things like that, are actually things that we should ignore as much as we can, I mean, while still obviously getting things done and functioning, but to not feel like we have to be productive every minute of the day. Because when you do that, you just get more work to do. You know, if you're the person who always responds to emails quickly, you're going to get more and more emails to respond to. If you're the person who does every task five times faster than your coworkers, you're going to be given more tasks to do. And so he says, if there are big things you want to do, if there's a side project that you're really passionate about, if you want to spend more time with your family or spend time starting a local political organization, you have to prioritize those things and accept that there are going to be things that don't get done. And so there's a sort of Zen acceptance of non-productivity in some ways. And then there's also these larger issues of just, if you get 4,000 weeks, you have to accept that there are going to be all kinds of things you never get to do. Even if you travel the world, there will be places you just don't see in that amount of time. And so, again, this is not a conventional, you know, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. It's a bit more of a wide-ranging essayistic book. And Berkman's a journalist whose work I've admired in the past. He's a very even-keeled sort of person. And And I enjoyed this book. It's not my kind of book because I'm very lazy. I actually don't care about how productive I am. And so I found myself at some points thinking, why would anyone want to?
Yeah.
Am I allowed to say, John, that you struggled to get this review in on time?
I want to say that I think that there's an unrecognized connection between laziness and productivity, in that at least my efficiency stems from what I see as a profound laziness, which is to say, and I think maybe there are others out there, that you want to get everything done so that you can lie around doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. that's kind of, I don't know.
Yes, no, I absolutely feel that way. You know, you want to have the weekend to just do your thing and not have to worry about it.
But the other part of me has a hard time justifying reading books about efficiency or time management or like about how busy we all are, because my gut instinct is to be like, yes, and so therefore I'm too busy to read this book.
One of the pleasures of reading this book is that I think Berkman on some level would agree with you. I mean, this is the book for the people who don't like these kinds of books, because he always has this slightly distanced meta take on it. And if you told him at the end of this book, what you've convinced me of is that I'm never going to read a practical book again, he'd say, great, if that's how you want to, he wouldn't say use your time because he doesn't like the idea of using time. But you know, if he thinks if that's your priority, ditch them. Who cares?
I feel like maybe one should always have this British guide to self-help books like Jeff Dyer or Berkman.
Yes, he's not quite as... Well, Jeff Dyer, I find so dry and so funny. Berkman's a little, I would put him a level below that level of archness, but he's definitely got that British dry wit. And it's very helpful when reading this kind of stuff. It's not that manic American, get it done, get ahead, succeed kind of tone. It's the tone of, well, we'd all rather be reading a Dickens novel or something, but let's address this for a bit. And I love that. Gal, how have you been using your reading time lately?
I, as I've mentioned on here before, I spent part of the pandemic in Los Angeles, and so I've been trying to read LA-based books in my free time. And the one that I'm almost at the end of now is Jill Liovey's Ghetto Side. It's a nonfiction book, came out in 2015. Liovey was a LA Times reporter who became sort of interested and bothered by the number of murders that were not being reported in the paper. She actually started a blog at one point to try to just, called the Homicide Report, that was trying to cover every murder in Los Angeles County in a single year. And most of those murders were in the part of LA that's called South Los Angeles, which is sort of south of the 10. People know Los Angeles, communities like Watts and Compton. You know, there was an extremely high murder rate among African-American men there. And she says very early on in the book, you know, this is like shocking statistic that, you know, 6% of the country's population are African-American men, but they're 40% of those who are murdered. And she tries to understand what's going on in this community, basically through the eyes of one case. It's very sort of Wire-ish, if you were a fan of that show, in that like she's understanding systems through narrative. And the narrative in this particular case focuses on two detectives. One is Wallace Tunnell, who's an African-American detective who actually lives in the neighborhood, which is an unusual thing. And the book starts off with his son, Brandon, who's just an 18-year-old, not a gang member per se, but he's wearing a hat, which is often how these murders would happen, wearing a hat with the colors of one of the neighborhood gangs, and he gets killed. And the investigation of that case by another detective named John Skaggs, who's almost is like this kind of archetypical police department homicide detective who just wants to do good in this situation where bureaucracy and the way people come to see the police in this neighborhood gets in the way of every attempt he has to try to solve this case. The case is typical in so many ways. I mean, it's just this happens all the time in these neighborhoods. And so we sort of follow him and understand the challenges. What I found really interesting about this book is that, you know, she sort of reported it before the Black Lives Matter movement, and certainly the kind of the defund part of that push, defunding the police. And her conclusion that she comes to is one that is interesting in that light, because she really actually feels that these communities want and need more police, but they need a certain type of police. They need detective work. They need justice to be brought in these murder cases for the cases to actually be solved. An insanely small percentage of these cases of kind of gang violence are actually solved in these neighborhoods. And so, and very few detectives are as committed as this guy Skaggs, who we follow, to really getting to the bottom of each of these murders. And so, given the sort of moment that we're in and the way that we're understanding the problem with police violence, it was interesting to see her very strongly sort of advocate for even more detective work. I mean, she's not talking about police patrolling. She's talking about actually committed work into the cracking of these cases.
Am I incorrect in thinking that when you look at polls among Americans about their attitudes towards more police, less police, that there's actually a greater desire among Black people in particular for more police than less?
I've actually looked into this for reasons that I won't go into here, but it depends on the community. And in some cases, I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as more, but, you know, in Minneapolis, for example, where the city council actually, in the middle of the Black Lives Matter protest last summer, said that they were going to abolish the police. There were polls done by the Minneapolis Star Tribune just, you know, 2 months after that, in which 50% of the Black residents said that they didn't want that, you know. So, and when you talk to people on the ground who are fighting to abolish or defund the police, they'll tell you, at least they've told me when I've reported this a little bit, that they encounter a lot of communities where that's not necessarily what they want. But I think it's complicated. And in this case, what Leovi is asking for, saying that it is needed, is less of the sort of random patrolling, the stop and search, the arresting on minor drug charges. That is actually creating the animosity and the fear. What is needed is people who are professionals who are trying to actually create a system of justice in these neighborhoods for when real crimes occur. So what about you, Pamela? What are you reading?
So I recently read a book, the most recent book by George Packer, Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. And he was here on the podcast talking about that book. I always like reading Packer's journalism. And I have to say, I never got around to reading Our Man, which I think, Gal, you were a fan of that book, right?
Yeah, very much so.
And I want to read it. It's a lot longer than this one. So I did get to this one first. And, you know, as people may recall, he wrote this using a political pamphlet as a model. So it is short and it had that advantage. But Packer's someone I admire not only as a thinker, but also he's a beautiful writer. And I was interested in this book because he's doing a rare thing, especially in our current very polarized political environment. He is empathetic and open to the other side. And then he also turns a critical eye to his own side. And he is, you know, I think fairly well known as very much a liberal writer. His book, The Unwinding, won a National Book Award. He's done a lot of foreign correspondence. He wrote the book, The Assassin's Gate. And just to do both of those things right now, to be open to trying to see what it's like in another person's shoes, politically speaking, and then also to turn a critical eye to question your own assumptions, it just feels really rare. I think it used to be, I don't know, you know, maybe I'm idealizing things. I'm always inclined to think that things were once better in certain ways than they currently are. But I think maybe people across the political spectrum, but perhaps especially on the liberal side, used to be more open to having their own assumptions questioned. Again, maybe I'm wrong. It feels good that he's doing that. You know, one other thing to say about this book is that I sort of surprised myself in wanting to read it, in that I've had a real aversion to reading books that look at contemporary politics, even though I know there are a lot of good ones out there. And I have many of them kind of sitting on my bookshelf, wanting to be read. One example is a book that our colleague Jen Salai gave a really positive review to, which was Tim Alberta's American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. I know it's supposed to be good. I know it's full of juicy tidbits and that the reporter got a lot of people to talk. But then I look at the title and I'm like, Carnage, Front Lines, Civil War. And I just am like, it's bedtime. Is this where I want to be? So I never end up reading them, or rarely in the last 6 years
have I read them, but this is one I did read and enjoy.
I've heard you talk about this book, Pamela, and you mentioned that he categorizes various political ideologies on the right and the left. Is it actually sort of a helpful way of thinking through where we're at?
I think so. And we talked about this in the podcast. He divides America into four groups. I found it a helpful framework because while two are broadly speaking on the right and two are broadly speaking on the left, I think he persuasively delineates the fissures on both sides. So he has on the right what he calls free America, which is, you know, the more libertarian streak, maybe a more traditional streak of American conservatism. And then he has Real America, which is sort of the more populist group on the right. And that the name Real America comes from Sarah Palin. So it's that Just Like Us school of American politics. And I think probably fundamentally explains in particular Donald Trump's following. And then on the left, and here again, I think just even in these names, Smart America, which, you know, he doesn't hardly mean as a compliment, and Just America. What's interesting about all of these names is that you can, I think, pretty quickly, if you're a politically aware person, grasp what he means and both the upside and the downside of each of those words, because there really is a clear double meaning in both of those, in all of those terms. So that's the way that he divides it. And I think that it clarifies not only the differences between the right and the left, but also the tensions on both sides.
I think I read an excerpt, maybe in The Atlantic, from the book. And I always find Packer, I also think he's a really good writer. And he's always sort of persuasive while I'm reading him. And I think I feel like I got the gist of the book from the piece. So I don't think I'll pick up the whole book, but I generally look at his stuff.
Do you guys both read around books looking for excuses not to read them?
Yeah. Well,
you can check it off and say.
That's right.
Well, I'm really mad at Gall because when Ghetto Side came out, we had some really great coverage of it. And I thought, oh, I should read that. But then I have forgotten about it until today. And now he's adding a book to think about and maybe to buy and to put on my pile.
Well, I have to say that I got to it through another one of our Ezra Klein's podcast in which he talked to James Foreman Jr. And this was the kind of the top book that he recommended. So I felt I sort of discovered it late, but I was happy to find it.
Now I need to go back and read Foreman's book too, which is excellent.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that was one of our 10 best books. actually, the book that I want to read from around that same period, and I still plan to, is Gary Young's book, which was called Another Day in the Death of America.
I'm going to have to stop both of you right here because at this point, my wallet and my living space are getting, the wallet's getting emptier and the living space is getting fuller. So we got to stop recommending
books. Your time management skills are top notch.
Right, right.
How am I going to find time to read all these?
All right, let's run down the titles of what we did read, John.
I read 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman.
And I read A Ghetto Side by Jill Leovi.
I read Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal by George Packer. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.